I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. In October of 2015, the El Faro, a U.S.-flagged cargo ship, sank in Hurricane Joaquin northeast of the Bahamas. Despite a seasoned crew, state-of-the-art navigation systems, and advance warning of the storm, the ship went down without sending out a mayday and without launching lifeboats. All 33 souls on board were lost. George Michelson Foy is a lifelong mariner and author. His recent book is Run the Storm, A Savage Hurricane, A Brave Crew, and the Wreck of the SS El Faro. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mindy. I'm glad to be here.
So as a mariner, what were your first thoughts when you heard about the sinking of the El Faro?
I was shocked. I think I had automatic empathy. I have to add that I'm not a mariner in the sense that these people were having spent 20, 30, even 40 years at sea. I worked as a deckhand and then an officer on small British tramp freighters in the North Sea. I worked on commercial fishing boats out of Cape Cod. But these guys were, almost all of them were real professionals, longtime professionals. But still, I've worked on the sea or sailed and so forth all my life. I think I started sailing before I actually learned to walk because my mother's family was really into it. So I had an automatic empathy, and I just felt for these people. I was shocked too, because this was a huge ship. This was a 31,000 ton ship. And she was very, very, very big. She was as long, I like to say, as an 80-story skyscraper is tall. She had navigational equipment that were really up to date. And again, a professional crew, American registered, American built, and supervised. So it was just overall a shock, but most of all empathy. These people went down in a hurricane in Joaquin that was a massive and freak storm, and it was just a terrible drama and something that affected me.
Yeah. So why did you start looking deeper into the events surrounding the sinking? You know, was a book always kind of in your mind, or was it curiosity? What got you looking at this?
No, I didn't want to write the book because the previous book that I wrote was about navigation, but not just maritime, everything from sails to spaceships. But it focused on my great-great-grandfather, who was the captain of a sailing coaster off the coast of Norway, ran into a storm. Ship capsized, sank, and he sank with the ship. So, and then the last novel I'd had published also centered around the shipwreck, the loss of a very large bulk carrier off the coast of Africa. This is all coincidental in a sense. These weren't the main events in the book, but I didn't want to be typecast as a shipwreck writer. Mm-hmm. But because I was living on the Cape, two of the officers on board were Mass Maritime graduates. One lived quite close in Kingston, Mass. And so there was that amount of kind of local involvement, and the local media kept good track of the ship because of that. So I kept track of it. But I didn't really want to write this book. I just kept informed because of my own professional interest in it. And then they retrieved the ship's black box from 3 miles down and published the transcript. And when I read the transcript, I was blown away, both because it was interesting from a professional point of view, from a seaman's point of view, it was interesting, but from a writer's point of view, it was like reading a Greek tragedy. And you just followed every moment of the last 26 hours of the ship's crew and officers on the bridge of the ship, and as they got closer to the storm and as they began to realize what kind of danger they were in and their human reactions to it. And I just felt, both as a mariner and as a writer, I had to
compelled
write this.
Yeah. So a black box, and that's sort of like what we're talking, the black boxes we hear about on airplanes, a recording device that, you know, captures that on the ship. Do merchant ships like commercial airplanes do most of them have these black boxes?
It really depends on their registry. I believe American ships over a certain tonnage are required to carry them. And I'm not sure to what extent they are required to cover every aspect of the ship. That was one of the facets that came up in the investigation, because El Faro's black box recorded some data pertaining to the engine, some navigational data, position, and so forth, and only the conversation on the bridge, and one-way conversation in the sense that if the captain got a phone call from the engine room, you could only hear his side of it. If he sent out a radio message, You can only hear his side of it.
So what was on there was just the conversation on the bridge.
Yep. It was like you were eavesdropping in the back of the bridge and listening to what everybody was saying.
Yeah, and he said the ship sank in very deep water, over 3 miles down. So it's pretty incredible that the recording device was found at all, isn't it?
Yeah. The NTSB Woods Hole Oceanographic participated in the search. The National Transportation Safety Board, the Coast Guard, and the Navy all cooperated and sent out a seagoing tug with a remotely operated vehicle, underwater vehicle, and they found the wreck initially, and then they went back. They had to go back, I believe, twice to finally locate the black box and retrieve it from that depth.
Was it tough to get access to that information?
They spent, I forget the total number of hours, but I think it's safe to say hundreds of hours trying to retrieve it. And of course, it was digitally recorded, which was the only reason they were able to get it at all. Mm. But the NTSB sound engineers sweated blood over that.
Yeah. So what new information did those recordings give to investigators?
Well, the details. And one of the fascinating things about this wreck and what attracted me as well as the human element was the way that quantum details, these tiny little microscopic things that go wrong, that break, that stress, and then add stress to the next factor down the line, which also breaks or what have you. I'm talking very vaguely, but we're talking about very specific things like the silicone in the gasket that seals a scuttle, a hatch. We're talking about metal fatigue. Again, so microscopic you can't quantify it. We're talking about aspects of the captain's psychology that were not evident from other sources. And all of that started to come out in listening to the transcript where you started to hear exactly in what sequence these things happened.
Mm. So would you have been able to write the book without those recordings?
Well, I wouldn't have, I think, because I was just blown away by the dramatic aspect of it. But the recording certainly added many layers of depth to some things that were already known. For example, the captain, as I said, they did not issue a mayday. Not technically, they didn't call out mayday, mayday, which you're required to do usually. Oddly enough, you're actually according to some sources, you're required to call the ship's owners first.
Interesting.
Which is kind of a weird aspect. And in fact, Davidson, the captain, Michael Davidson, did call the safety officer at Tote Maritime, or Tote Incorporated, and to explain first what was going on. But he was, and again, this drilling deep into his psychology, he was an inveterate optimist, apparently, a very, very good mariner, but an inveterate optimist, also a doomsday prepper. Mm. And there's a quirk of that kind of psychology that seems to imply that once you've prepared for nuclear holocaust or zombie apocalypse or what have you, then you kind of figure you've covered your bases and everything's going to be hunky-dory. And that was very much the way he sounded. But he called the safety officer and he said, well, we've taken in some water, but we're dewatering, we're pumping the water out, we're in the storm, but everything's okay, and we're going to stick with the ship. Mm. And in fact, he didn't say anything negative on the bridge, according to the VDR, to the transcript, until about an hour before the ship actually went down. Wow. And that was the first time he said, I'm not liking the look of this.
Oh. So did you actually get to hear the voices on the recorder, or you just read the transcript?
No, NTSB, and I think justifiably, did not let people listen to the actual recording unless possibly family mm-hmm. members wanted to. The only voice I actually heard was Davidson, because they did release the voicemail. He initially called the safety officer and who was not available, and it went to voicemail. And then he called the company and he got an answering service. And one of the brutal things in the transcript is his attempt to get through to the usual kind of answering service operator who's saying, yes, sir, and how may I help you? And can you spell the name of your ship? And I'm just going to put you on hold for a little while. And you can hear Davidson going, the clock is ticking. Yeah. The clock is ticking. Mm. Please let me talk to somebody.
So explain the work of the El Faro. Where was she heading and what was she carrying?
She was on a milk run, basically, from Jacksonville, Florida, to Puerto Rico. She and her sister ship alternated so that each ship was going north or south on alternate weeks. And And their role was vital in terms of keeping the island equipped with everyday necessities, everything from cars and forklifts and oil and food and Pop-Tarts and
everything
safety razors,
needed, yeah.
Everything, yeah. All of which, or a lot of which, washed up on surrounding islands following the disaster, which was very odd. Deodorants, for example, were just, you know, hundreds of canisters or roll-on stick deodorants washed up on San Salvador. But apparently Puerto Rico's shelves were empty following the El Faro's sinking for a number of days until El Yunque, which was her sister ship, completed her run and came back to Puerto Rico.
Yeah. So these ships alternated between Jacksonville and San Juan. How often were these trips made?
They did a round trip every 2 weeks.
Every 2 weeks.
More or less.
Yeah, so tell us more about the crew that was on board. You mentioned they were all seasoned, but who was the crew?
They were all seasoned. They were all Americans except for a five-man riding gang. And I say five-man because they were all men. They were Polish, and they were charged with refitting the ship for Alaska because she's going to be transferred to a northern run. Which required mostly a lot of de-icing equipment and then conversion back from a roll-on, roll-off and container ship to purely roll-on, roll-off. In other words, where you can drive a truck aboard, just park it, and then the ship takes it somewhere else and you drive it off. Mm. And because she was an intra-American trade ship, a Jones Act ship, they're called conform to a law that was passed in 1920 that going from American port to American port, you can only have a ship that is owned by Americans, built by Americans, and crewed by Americans. And so she was all USA. Mm-hmm. She was built 1975 in Philadelphia, and her crew, except for the riding gang, were all Americans. And as I said before, they were all real professionals. Some of them had been at sea a long, long time. All of us were very used to the route, which may have been a factor too, because there was a certain amount of complacency. It seems evident in certainly the captain's attitude and possibly. Possibly some of the crew, but certainly the captain, you can hear it recorded where he says over and over again, this is nothing. This ship's been through this stuff in Alaska before. This ship can take it. And usually that run is warm. The seas are relatively calm. But then again, it's also the so-called Bermuda Triangle, and it's a prime hurricane area. Mm-hmm. And a hurricane is what they ran into.
As part of your research, you talk with some of the families of those who were lost. How did those interviews help shape the narrative of the book?
Well, they gave me a real insight into the people, and the families that I ended up talking to were incredibly generous. I mean, it was very hard for them to talk about their daughter or their son or their husband or fiancé. And they told me, I think, very, very, very honestly and with very little reservation about who these people were. I didn't go into the book trying to find bad apples or try to find who had committed some horrible mistake and caused the ship to sink. The evidence seems to indicate that there were a bunch of different factors involved, and they all came together in this way that really interested me, the way that disasters happen, where it's not one thing, it's not even like one clear action on the part of one person, but a multitude of different factors that then snowball. But I felt like I got to know them. I couldn't talk to Michael Davidson's family. You know, I think they were pretty much gagged by their settlement with Tote. Mm. But I talked to, for example, the family of Second Mate Randolph, who was from Maine, and she was a 30-something. Somebody described her as a firecracker, and that's kind of what she was. She was very, very spunky. She was very, very good at her job. And she was somebody who'd wanted to go to sea since kindergarten, and her mom told a story whereby she was taking her for her first day of kindergarten, and her mom, Lori, was crying, and Danielle looked up at her and said, well, you know, don't cry, Mom, because I have to go to school, because otherwise I can't go to sea, which is what I want to do. And in fact, she also told her mom that when she graduated from Maine Maritime and her mom was worried about some of the dangers involved, and she said, you know, again, don't worry. If something happens to me at sea, it's where I want to be. Mm. And a lot of these people were really committed mariners. And committed mariners will often bitch about the trade and the loneliness of it, the long hours. It's good pay. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of drawbacks to it, especially if you want some kind of family life. But they also tend to be proud of their trade and involved in, I think, the way of life of the sea, which really is a way of life, yeah. whether you like it or indifferent to it, but it does permeate your bones and it allows you to talk to any other mariner from any other part of the world. There was also the guy who was most local, Jeff Mathias. His wife was the first one I talked to in starting to research the book, and she and her family were very generous as far as giving me information about Jeff. And little details are what fascinated me. For example, the Mathias family is involved in cranberry farming. And Jeff, as a kid, first became interested in machines through the medium of farm machinery and cranberry farming machinery specifically, the trucks, the conveyor belts, that kind of thing. And he grew to love trying to figure out how to fix these things and find a part that was hard to find and fit that and get and repair the thing. A lot of the engineers were actually really fascinated by steam, and steam engines were the traditional way of powering large merchant ships. They've since been replaced by large diesels in modern ships, but Elfara was old. She was 40 years old, and she had a steam plant. And Jeff Mathias and the first engineer and the chief engineer, Jeff was a chief engineer, but he was in charge of the conversion. So there was another chief engineer, Rich Pizzuteri, who was the official chief engineer. And the first engineer, Griffin, who was a Mass Maritime graduate, and also the second, Howard Chinley. A lot of the crew were the engineering crew were fascinated with steam because it's a complex and kind of beautiful system. It has kind of two sides to it. One is the evaporation side, where you heat water to make steam, and the other is the condensation side, where you condense the water and bring it back into the cycle. And oddly enough, that replicates how hurricane works. I mean, that's a purely sort of philosophical analogy to make, but these people love that kind of machinery too. And just as I think the officers were involved in navigation and meteorology, again, the whole way of life of seagoing.
Yeah. We're talking with George Michelson Foy about his book, Run the Storm, A Savage Hurricane, A Brave Crew, and the Wreck of the SS El Faro. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. With us this morning is George Michelson Foy, who is the author of Run the Storm, A Savage Hurricane, A Brave Crew, and the Wreck of the SS El Faro. As El Faro embarks on her final voyage, it's about 30 miles from Florida. There are no other merchant ships showing up on the radar. And you write, other merchant ships should show up as orange wedges with their automatic identification system transponder, or AIS info, flagged on the radar screen. But now there are zero, none at all. It turns out later they have either stayed in port or scooted back to shelter because of Joaquin. So there appears to have been enough information about the weather system to keep other merchant ships from the region, but not El Faro. So at that point, how much information did El Faro have about the impending weather?
El Faro had a lot of information, and that's one of the conundrums of the disaster. They received the ordinary National Weather Service National Hurricane Center transmissions at 5 and 11 a.m. and p.m., and they also subscribe to a bespoke meteorology prediction service called Bon Voyage, which belonged to Advanced Weather Technology. Anyway, they package the same information, the National Weather Service information, and then they make pretty graphics and make it sort of much more easy to assimilate than the NWS text messages, which tend to be a little bit dense. And I think one aspect of this tragedy was that Captain Davidson especially seemed to be sort of hooked on the Bon Voyage graphics. And there's a general problem with the forecasting. First, hurricanes are very difficult to predict, first of all. And NWS usually does a very good job predicting what happens with the hurricanes. But they're incredibly complex beasts. Again, going back to these quantum details, they're so complex you cannot possibly analyze every element that goes into them. So there's going to be error. They had way more error in their predictions to begin with than usual. They were about 180 miles off, 3 days out from the tragedy, and 60 knots plus in terms of error as to the strength of the wind. So there were errors to begin with. Then every hurricane prediction is going to be 6 hours late 3 hours late because the National Weather Service takes 3 hours to assimilate all the data and run it through their massive computers and then spit out what their predictions are going to be. And then Bon Voyage takes another 6 hours to turn it into a graphics package. And then it has to wait till the next slot for transmission. On top of that, they had a computer error. Mm-hmm. So that at one point, the pretty graphics package with the track of the hurricane and the track of the ship that Davidson was really relying on was 21 hours old.
Oh, boy.
The text had been refreshed, but the graphics, because of the glitch, had not. And he and other members of the crew seemed to be very reliant on that graphic, so it's quite possible that was one of the reasons that for Davidson's optimism as well as his psychological bent to kind of look on the bright side of things.
I want to ask you about a passage from the book where you're describing the storm. You write, no one among those who knew and cared for El Faro realized that the troublesome, wayward delinquent that Joaquin once seemed had grown up with exceptional speed and horrific energy into the meteorological equivalent of a monster, a serial killer whose apparent drive to pursue and destroy El Faro caused not a few to endow the storm with psychotic intent. Now, we know that weather systems don't have intent. They can't target victims or stalk them. So why did you choose to portray the hurricane in that way?
Well, I think it's human to ascribe human characteristics to events that have a big impact on you. I think Ruskin called it the pathetic fallacy. And, of course, hurricanes are not conscious. But Joaquin, first of all, is unusual. It came off the African coast much further to the north, farther to the north than most hurricanes do. And then it seemed to be kind of innocuous. It didn't really pick up a lot of power. And everybody, most of the forecast dismissed the hurricane as, well, not a hurricane. It was going to stay a tropical storm, and then it would veer north and stay west and then veer north the way most hurricanes track up the east coast and then out to sea. But I won't go into the complexities of it, but there were two weather systems. One was pushing it from the Atlantic to the south and west, and then another was coming off the North American continent. And the system to the north and east was more influential on the storm than people realized. There were also other factors which are kind of in general attributable to global warming, in that the water that Joaquin ended up running over on its way toward El Faro was 2 degrees warmer than normal. It was a record temperature. And warm water is like gasoline to a car for a hurricane. It's fuel. And so at that point, Joaquin, in a 24-hour period, went from it had turned into a Category 1 hurricane at that point, which is 75 miles per hour, more or less. And then in that 24-hour period, it became as Category 2, then Category 3. And when around the time El Faro went down, turned into a Category 4 storm with winds up close to 150 miles an hour.
Hard to even imagine.
No. I mean, as I write in the book, you're going to get blown off. Whatever you were trying to hang on to is going to get blown off and mm-hmm. blown right after you. And it's I think very few people have been through that kind of thing and survived. But there was but the confluence of these two systems made it so that not only did Joaquin seem to be heading straight for El Faro, but at the point when El Faro sank or was about to sink, the storm slowed down and started to stall. And then the other system from the continent pushing toward the east caused the storm to actually circle around El Faro as she sank and after she sank.
Yeah. Talk about being in the wrong place at the wrong time, huh?
So it feels like, I mean, if you were a mystic and ascribed real human qualities to this hurricane, you'd think it was an assassin and it was trying to kill this ship and her crew.
Yeah. You do note that Tope Maritime, who owned and operated El Faro, didn't seem to take note of the storm either. How typical is it for an owner to monitor the weather and advise ships in these circumstances?
Well, there are any number of ship owners, and I certainly didn't do a survey of them. By way of example, Maersk has an operations board, a massive digital thing, where they're the biggest shipping line in the world, but they keep track digitally of all their ships all the time. Tote did not, and there's a few reasons for that. One is that, as I said, it was a milk run, and they were just used to this kind of regular shuttle back and forth, and I think they just kind of stopped paying attention. But another is that the company, which was originally a fairly old-fashioned transportation company, was owned by a big holding company, private holding company in Washington State, had been relatively easygoing as to its business plan and had no problem kind of keeping ships maintained and equipment maintained. Apparently in 2012, there was a change of management and they began a much more hard-edged cost-cutting and profit-oriented routine that resulted in fewer shoreside staff and less supervision of the ship's operations. In fact, the NTSB, the chief of the NTSB, the team that was investigating, at one point called it a colossal failure in management. And they did not keep track of where the ships were, not specifically. They just relied on what's called the noon report, where captains radio in where they are and some other information. And they only had one person, really, one or two people even in charge of fielding communication from the ship. And so they didn't know where she was. They had also really dropped the ball as far as routine maintenance. So that, for example, at one point, among the numerous factors that contributed to the sinking was a list, which that is a tilt of the ship because of the amount of water that she had taken in through a hatch, a scuttle. That list, in turn, caused a malfunction in the lubrication system, which relied on a certain depth of oil in the sump of the turbines, mm-hmm. to get really technical, but for the engine to keep functioning. What the engineers didn't know was that there was a direct correlation between tilt and ability to lubricate the engine. Over 15 degrees at the normal operating or the standard operating level of oil in the engine, the intake pipe would start to suck dry and stop lubricating the turbines, and the engine would automatically shut down. And when your ship loses power in a storm like that, she becomes helpless. Mm. But there was no up-to-date manual detailing this. So the engineers had to kind of guess what was going on. They also didn't know that the oil intake pipe, and this was a structural issue that should have been well known to the engineers, that should have been well known to the company, that they should have included in a manual. The intake pipe was 21 inches on the right side of the ship, the starboard side, so that if the ship listed to starboard, that actually helped. It increased the level of oil on the starboard side. But if she then, and this is what happened, they asked for the ship, when they started having problems with the oil level, they asked for the ship to be turned to port. At that point, the oil all sloshed over to port, to left, which meant that the intake side on the starboard side was sucking even drier than it had been before. And that's when the engine died.
Mm. Now, there's a longer route to San Juan from Jacksonville, which would put the ship in the lee of the weather. In fact, even before the ship encounters heavy weather, several of the crew suggested this alternate route to the captain. What were they seeing that concerned them but didn't seem to concern the captain? And I know we'd be speculating here, but do you think that alternate route would have provided adequate protection from the storm?
It seems likely that it would. And what the second mate and the third mate were seeing, and they saw it, the third mate was on duty up till midnight of the night preceding the ship sinking. She sank at about 7:40 on October 1st. And at about 11 p.m., on September 30th, Jeremy Ream, the third mate, called the captain and said, "It looks like we're getting close to the hurricane on the projected course." They had already done a little bit of a dogleg around San Salvador, or planned to. But even with that dogleg, it looked like the storm was going to get close within 20, 30 miles. And he called Davidson, and Davidson said, don't worry. He woke Davidson up. Davidson went to sleep, what turned into his cabin at about 8 p.m. on September 30th. And he did not get up till 4 a.m. on October 1st, which was about 3.5 hours, a little bit more, before El Faro sank. And that certainly came up in the hearing. And then the second mate called at about 1:30 a.m. on October 1st, Danielle Randolph, Same thing, and she talked to the third mate about this, and they both agreed that this looked they were playing footsie with a hurricane, and just basic mariner's training teaches you that you don't do that. Mm. You get the hell out of the way. And she called Davidson at the point and said, "Let's take this escape route south." And there are not too many escape routes. And I talk about escape routes in the context of the Bahamas chain, mm-hmm. which are coral and shallows, and they're death for large ships, generally speaking. But there are two or three kind of inlets and passages that you can weave through the chain. And there was one right at that point. In fact, very close to the point where the hurricane met the ship ultimately. And it is, I think, likely, if not more than likely, that if they had gone south at that point through that escape route through the Bahamas chain, they would have survived. But again, there was Davidson's optimism. There also may have been a factor whereby it's been called tickling the dragon's tail, whereby people are so confident not only of the size and strength of their ship, but she was a well-built ship, big, mm-hmm. huge, and also very well-powered. She could go very fast. But also her navigational systems were up to date. They were GPS. They could locate the ship to within meters of her position. And tickling the dragon's tail is known by some as being overconfident in your ability to kind of just micromanage your course mm-hmm. in relation to, say, these big weather events. And certainly before GPS and before this confidence in your in one's ability to find one's way within meters, no captain would have gotten that close because, there, first of all, the escape route would have been impossible in any kind of storm because navigation was by sextant and by piloting, and in bad visibility you couldn't do that, and you'd be going into this area of coral reefs and sand and really unable probably to be confident of getting out of there with any safety. So tickling the dragon's tail may have been one of the factors at play here. Michael Davidson's optimism, not shared by his officers.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's interesting that he could go to sleep and sleep through that. As you're mentioning, the three mates are all discussing at various times their concerns. And third mate, Jeremy Rehm, charts that they will be 22 miles from the center of the storm with max winds at 100 miles an hour gusting to 120 and strengthening. And when he relays that information, the captain doesn't appear to be concerned. So Rehm doesn't press the issue or question the captain's decision. Does that surprise you?
Yes and no. And I talk about it in the book. Obviously, maritime tradition relies on kind of unquestioning obedience to the captain. That authority is really drilled into mariners, and it's drilled into them, and certainly in maritime academies. Because in a tight situation, you have to have a very clear chain of command, and there's no time. Mm-hmm. There's no time to
second guessing
mm-hmm. or arguing. That being said, and going back to the maritime academies, they're subsidized by the U.S. government in large part because the government feels it necessary to have a lot of maritime officers available for wartime or for service in the Navy. So that Navy discipline of tradition, whereby cadets are in uniform and drilling on the parade mm-hmm. ground, and it is part of the whole thing. And they're certainly taught, you obey first, you obey orders first, and you ask questions afterward. Mm-hmm. But again, that being said, there are other philosophies of command, and the NTSB certainly pushed hard in their investigation to understand why people had not adopted something called bridge resource management, whereby you adopted a more collegial approach to these decisions. My experience of seagoing and of merchant officers is that, they're aware of that. There are mechanisms whereby you can make your disagreement known. But basically, if you object too much, or if you make of yourself too much of a pain in the butt, you're just not going to get hired again.
We're talking with George Michelson Foy about his book, Run the Storm, A Savage Hurricane, A Brave Crew, and the Wreck of the SS El Faro. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. With us this morning is George Michelson Foy, who is the author of Run the Storm, A Savage Hurricane, A Brave Crew, and the Wreck of the SS El Faro. Now, the Alfaro passes her sister ship en route from San Juan to Jacksonville, and they talk on the radio, and the chief mate from the sister ship, I can't remember how to say it. What's the sister ship's name again?
El Yunque.
Yeah, El Yunque, mentions that their captain says the Alfaro is going the wrong way. Did you talk with the captain or crew from the sister ship about their thoughts as they seemed steam past the El Faro heading into that weather?
They testified at the hearings. There were 6 weeks of hearings, three different hearings, and there were dozens and dozens of witnesses of all different stripes, including the captain and mates of El Yunque. And so they talked about it. That was basically meant as a somewhat humorous comment because clearly they were going generally in the direction of the hurricane, but they, El Faro's officers tell El Yunque that basically we figure we're going to scoot around. And this was kind of Davidson's mantra, was that he was going to sneak around the back of the storm. And till at least an hour and a half to an hour before the sinking, Michael Davidson is still saying, we're in the back of this, it's only going to get better. Again, partly his optimism, partly the over-reliance on a faulty weather forecast graphic, and partly just the general unpredictability of the storm combined to put El Faro in harm's way. But a more prudent traditional officer, or an officer hewing to more traditional maritime knowledge and education, would simply, out of general principles, have stayed farther away from the storm.
You talked about some of the things that were happening that contributed to the ship going down, and it appears that there was little warning that the ship was going down. So maybe that's why there was no mayday to the Coast Guard, and it seemed as if the ship sank fairly soon after the captain rang the general alarm bell to alert the crew. Were there warning signs that the crew missed, or weather that rough that it's difficult to keep up with damage assessment and control? I mean, what ultimately caused the ship to sink? The fact that the engines went down?
Again, it's small detail snowballing. There was the fact that they were in rough seas to begin with. The hatch cover blew off, possibly from corrosion of the gasket, allowing water to enter the ship. This caused a tilt of the ship. There may also have been, and this cannot be proved apparently one way or the other, but there may also have been metal fatigue that contributed to water coming in through structural failure. But again, that's unprovable. They did not notice that the hatch was open for a long time. They didn't realize that the ship was taking on water. And the Coast Guard and the NTSB subsequently recommended that ships always have alarms to indicate whether a hatch is open, as they do on watertight doors and other parts of the ship. The water coming in caused the ship to tilt. The tilt caused the oil to slosh over to one side and the engine to suck air instead of oil, so that the turbine stopped, the engine stopped, and then the ship was in bad position. There's a possibility that there was a fire intake pipe that broke. And then you go back to the issues in cargo lashing because of lack of supervision, lack of a good manual. And again, kind of the milk run aspect of this run, some of the cargo was not properly lashed for heavy weather. Mm-hmm. And in that case, some of the cars, and El Faro carried a lot of cars to Puerto Rico, some of them used, which probably dripped oil, which contributed possibly to the corrosion of the gasket. Mm. You see how fascinating
and
complex
thing after
it gets.
Another,
But some of the cars probably got loose and may have rammed into that fire pipe, which meant that there was a pipe leading directly to the ocean that started gushing seawater. And the NTSB figures that alone might have contributed. There's no actual indication of that. That was sort of a theory that the engineers brought up, but they didn't notice the water coming through the scuttle, through the hatch, for a while. And the captain and the officers attributed the ship's list at first to the wind, which certainly was a factor, mm-hmm. because you've got a four deep load of containers on deck, and the wind's pushing against that as if it were a wall. That is a wall. And so at first they thought that, but they actually, the officers did not have sufficient knowledge, for one reason or another, of exactly what the strength of wind would do to this kind of a ship, because she had not been a container ship before. She'd just been roll-on, roll-off. Mm. So that they didn't actually have any data to go by they had a software program that reckoned stability and how far the ship would tilt one way or another with this kind of load, that center of gravity. But they couldn't, they didn't have access to that or didn't know how to tweak the program to take that into account. So at first they didn't realize that this was because they were taking water in.
Now, Alfaro is a U.S. flagship and as such subject to U.S. maintenance regulations. Yet because of her age, she was exempt from some aspects of the law, including some of the safety gear requirements. So describe Alfaro's lifeboats and compare them to modern day lifeboats that newer merchant ships are equipped with.
Alfaro's lifeboats were like the Titanics, except she had enough of them to carry the whole crew and then some. But they were open, and they were davit launched off the sides of the ship, which meant that if you had a list of, or tilt of the ship of more than 15 degrees, you basically couldn't launch them because on the side that the ship was tilting toward, the lifeboat would be too far off the side of the ship to board. On the other side, they would be scraping against the side of the ship and couldn't be launched. Not only that, but an open lifeboat in seas that went from 20 to 30 to maybe close to 50 feet, you just wouldn't survive. Mm. 120 knot winds, the lifeboats would be swamped and capsized and blown against the ship and crushed and so forth. They found one lifeboat adrift, and the lifeboat had been broken in two, and there were just kind of shards of fiberglass. Mm. In modern ships, as subject to modern regulations, and the regulation aspect is very relevant that you bring up, the older ships, because of ship owner pressure, because of the Jones Act, because they have to use American-built and crewed ships, ship owners complain that they have much higher costs. It costs way more than double to run an American ship than it does a foreign flag registered ship, which will have crew from Philippines and be built in Korea, et cetera. So they lobbied for and got a looser regulatory system. And also because of the age of the ship, they ended up allowing these open lifeboats. Modern ships built in America have to have totally enclosed lifeboats that are very, very solidly built. Not only that, but they're launched off a chute off the back of the ship, off the stern, so that the whole crew piles in, they seal it, they slam the hatch shut, and then they use a remote device to basically, it's like firing a torpedo off a ship or a rocket. The lifeboat just slides down this track off the stern of the ship and rockets out into the ocean some feet away from the sinking ship or the burning ship or whatever. Yeah. And that certainly increases your chances of survival. And it's possible, though not certain, because even that kind of lifeboat and those kind of seas could have been taken up by the waves and thrown back on the ship and crushed. Mm. But it's certainly possible that the crew could have survived that. They could not have survived in an open lifeboat. They didn't even try.
Yeah.
They knew that. They went straight to the life rafts.
So how did the world learn of the sinking of the ship?
I write there was no May Day, and in fact there wasn't. I mean, May Day technically is an officer getting on VHF or single sideband radio and calling May Day, May Day, we're in trouble, this is our position, help. And the Coast Guard, the National Transportation Safety Board and the Coast Guard faulted him for that. So he said, I kind of understand that because, the deck that he and and his deckhand on the bridge at the end were standing on was almost vertical at that point. And water was coming in. I mean,
you know you're in trouble.
You're in trouble, but also it's physically difficult to do anything other than save yourself. And in fact, he and the deckhand did not. But they'd also send automated messages. Mm-hmm. And there was, through the Inmarsat satellite system, there were two pre-programmed messages ready to go out, which recorded the ship's position. And those had been sent. Mm-hmm. And the Coast Guard received those and figured the ship was in trouble. There were data included in that indicated the ship was in trouble, but not that the ship was sinking. And in fact, nobody was sure what had happened to Alfaro for a good 24 hours. Mm-hmm. The captain in charge of the Coast Guard investigation told me that they were really hoping that either the ship had survived or the crew had survived, and that their antennas had been blown off, and that's why they didn't get a radio message.
There were investigations, as you mentioned, by the Coast Guard and the National Transportation Safety Board about the sinking. So what did they determine?
Well, they determined everything we've been talking about, all these different factors that came into the tragedy. They made various recommendations. One was that that regulatory system we just talked about be overhauled. I'm not sure. And there hasn't been anything really concrete happened yet. Certainly that there be totally enclosed lifeboats on all ships at this point. And again, there hasn't been anything concrete as a result of this. And I actually wonder whether there will be, because I believe the current administration in the White House is just is implementing an executive order, which oddly enough, I actually remember the number, which is 13771, which recommends loosening regulations in the maritime industry so that ship owners don't have to invest inordinate amounts of money in things like safety. But Tote Maritime has taken some measures. They scrapped the sister ship of El Yunque. They brought more modern ships onto the Puerto Rico run. They've changed answering services so that hopefully a captain calling in with a distress call is not going to be put on hold.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
That sort of thing.
So do we find that throughout the merchant marine industry? I mean, from these lessons learned from this tragedy, you mentioned Tote Marine making some different changes. Do we see that throughout the industry?
It's kind of too early to tell. Mm-hmm. The previous big maritime tragedy was the Marine Electric in 1983, which I think there were 31 people died on that ship. She was a very old ship like El Faro. She had corrosion issues, as El Faro did, and corrosion in the vents leading to the upper decks was quite possibly a factor in how quickly she went down, because water could come in those at a lesser degree of list than they should or they would ordinarily if the vents were whole. The Marine Electric was, again, had a lot of rust, as did El Faro. But the biggest change that came from the Marine Electric tragedy was that a lot of old ships were scrapped, and also that survival suits were required for every crew member aboard. What's going to come from the El Faro tragedy is hard to tell, especially with a relatively anti-regulatory environment in Washington. Mm-hmm. But I think ship owners they're not conscienceless people. They don't want their ships to sink or their mariners to die. A lot of the Tote people were crushed about mm-hmm. this. They knew the crew personally. And I think responsible ship owners are certainly going to take this into account. And at the very least, I think there will be a requirement that that all lifeboats on American ships now be totally enclosed. And
yeah. Multiple lawsuits were brought in the aftermath of the tragedy. Did they determine responsibility, or what happened with the lawsuits?
They were all settled by Tote. Mm-hmm. I don't know for exactly how much, because there was also a confidentiality agreement that was part of the mm-hmm. settlements. The rumor is that they were around $500,000 per family, but mm-hmm. I have no proof of that. But certainly it did result in there being kind of a blanket of relative silence that settled over the whole issue. Mm-hmm. When I talked to families, they could talk to me about things that were public record, but they couldn't say, I think the company was criminally involved in this. I think this is an absolute crime that this mm-hmm. should have happened, or at least not on the record.
Mm-hmm. So there wasn't anybody really, or any like responsibility for this. It's sort of like this chain of events that we're talking about. That's how we've determined the responsibility for what happens. Partly the captain, partly the ship, partly a little bit of a lot of things.
But I think that's fair. I mean, mm-hmm. I think it was partly the captain's responsibility. It was equally Tote's responsibility for failing to maintain the ship. One failure was the anemometer, which measures wind direction and speed. And when you're in the dark and in hurricane conditions, you have no idea what's going on outside. You just can't see. Mm. There's too much rain and spume and so forth. But the anemometer will tell you where the wind's coming from, and therefore, most generally speaking, where the waves are coming from, so that you can handle your ship better and safer in those conditions. You can also tell where the storm is. And if that anemometer had been working correctly, and Davidson had asked twice that it be fixed, and Tote was slow in doing so. In fact, they didn't fix it. Mm-hmm. And if you're trained in basic meteorology as a ship's officer, and you know from where the wind is, where the storm is, essentially, and based on where the wind was, he should have known that he had not gotten through to the backside of the storm as he believed.
Yeah.
And so again, so Tote was responsible. There were the errors in weather forecasting were mm-hmm. responsible. And the general regulatory environment, which was too loose, was responsible. But I think it's fair to say that all of those were mixed up, and you can't point to one
right.
and say this was the real. Well, yeah, you can. It was Hurricane Joaquin. Hurricane Joaquin was a killer, and it wanted that ship.
Right. The book is "Run the Storm: A Savage Hurricane, A Brave Crew, and the Wreck of the SS El Faro." We'll have a link with more information at our website, including book signings, CapeAndIslands.org. George Michelson Foy, thanks so much for coming in and sharing your book with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.